2,000 years of church history. Last week we looked at the first 1,000 in overview, and this week we want to look at the last 900 years. History is important. It tells us what has worked and it tells us what has not worked. We need to develop the ability to recognize these lessons in every area of life. The reformer John Calvin said, histories are a true school for learning how to order our lives. 1 Corinthians 10 verse 6 says, now these things occurred as examples to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things. Revelation 11 verse 15 tells us the goal of history. The kingdoms of this world have become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. If you've heard Handel's Messiah beating out this verse, it's just the most triumphant, memorable refrain. Yes, and he shall reign forever and ever. And that is where history is going. All nations will come and worship before Christ. It will happen. Well, we ended last week with the Crusades. Let us begin this week on the overview with the founding of universities in Paris and Oxford in particular. Oxen Ford, the oxen crossing Ford at on the Thames River, became the University of Oxford. And it's a university town. The town was just an oxen ford where they built up a university around it. And of course, it was the missionary monks who had discipled Europe who established these first universities. And all the great universities of the world were founded initially by Christians. And where some are now trying to say, oh no, but the Muslims had universities, no, they did not. They might have called it that afterwards, but they were just places where they learned their theology, not places where they dealt with all the different issues from medical all the way through to science that the Christian universities are. And the very name university again reminds us of its Christian roots. Uni veritas, one truth. The pagans don't even believe there is one truth, let alone that you can know it. Also very significant, date with destiny, 1177 AD, the Waldensian movement under Peter Waldo begins, and they start to begin a back-to-the-Bible movement that dramatically affected the whole of southern France and parts of northern Italy and even into the Alps of Switzerland. The Waldensian movement, very powerful, back-to-the-Bible movement. Mightily important in the history of constitutions and statutes, the Magna Carta, 1215. The barons of England at the point of the sword at Runnymede force the wicked King John, that's the degenerate reprobate brother of the mighty Richard the Lionheart. Richard Lionheart, one of the most popular kings of England's history, and his brother John, one of the worst and most unpopular kings of England, just showing you that things don't necessarily run the family. And the Magna Carta, written by a pastor, Stephen Langton, saturated with scripture. It's the first statute, the very first written restriction on the powers of government. All bills of rights, all constitutions date back to the Magna Carta. This is the granddaddy of them all. King John did not want to sign it, but he was forced by military might of his barons to sign it. And there's a very lovely quote in Winston Churchill's History of English-Speaking Peoples when he said, the people of England owe more to the vices of Prince John than to the virtues of any other man for their liberties. Now, what he means is that nobody would have forced someone as honourable and as respected as Richard the Lionheart, for example, or King Alfred the Great, to sign the Magna Carta. It took someone as vile and as treacherous and as low as King John to force the barons of England to get out there and compel him to sign a document that forever afterwards restricted the powers of the monarchy. And whereas monarchies in Europe were going totalitarian, especially in France, the monarchy in England started to go in a constitutional direction with restraint. And the Magna Carta, for example, guarantees rights of property, rights of freemen to carry weapons and never to have their rights infringed, the right of trial by jury, that you're innocent until proven guilty, all sorts of things, and restricts government, and the people cannot be taxed unless their representatives have approved such a tax. In fact, it's the Magna Carta that's the foundation of the American Bill of Rights. Remember that the American founding fathers were actually Englishmen and Germans, other Anglo-Saxons, who were across the seas saying, our chartered rights as Englishmen are being violated. The king is not ruling the colonies of America in accordance to the Magna Carta. We are not having our property secured. We are not having these due process of law honored as the Magna Carta, the Great Charter, required. And so, in a real sense, no Magna Carta, no Bill of Rights, no United States. The Magna Carta is monumentally important for all Bills of Rights. Even our flawed Bill of Rights in South Africa can be traced in some form back to this. So if there's anything good in it, it comes basically from the Magna Carta, and through that in the scriptures. Bad. Date of destiny, AD 1231, the Papal Inquisition was established by Pope Gregory the Ninth, and this was in order to force people to get right with the Church. Now, it started with something that you could have said was maybe possibly justified. Spain had been under the control of the Muslims for 8 centuries. The Muslims had been tormenting, enslaving, abusing the people of Spain and Portugal so badly that now, as Spain started to be liberated, the Inquisition was initially established with the goal of taking those people who had been heretics or had betrayed Christians into the hands of the Muslims, or who had turned their faith and had actually apostatized and gone to Islam, to bring them back to the Catholic faith. So it had something justifiable in the beginning, but very soon they were using it to abuse Protestants, evangelicals, people who believed the Bible, Waldensians, Albigensians, Lollards, and so on. So Inquisition started with a possibly plausible reason, but degenerated very quickly. AD 1347, the Black Plague, the Black Death, as they called it, decimated Europe. And this plague was carried by fleas that lived on rats. Now, the epidemic originated in Asia, and it came into Europe by ships that landed in Venice from China, and they were not only offloading spices from the east, they were offloading lice-bearing rats. And part of the problem is that Europe in the Middle Ages, just before this, had gone through a tremendous bout of superstition. And one of the biggest superstitions was that cats were bad and cats were witchcraft and all the cats were in league with the devil. And so there'd been a tremendous persecution of cats, and cats had been decimated out of Europe and chased out of the cities to such an extent that when the rats came in, the people didn't have protection, and the rats spread, and it spread so fast. You can see how 1347, all the areas in southern Europe were taken, one third of all the people killed. And then 1348 reached Germany, got over the Alps in Belgium, and then Poland, and then Russia, and you can see how it just spread so fast through the whole of Europe. In just a couple of years, one out of every three people is dead. In some cities, it was as much as two out of every three people were dead. And at first, they didn't know what was causing it. But when they realized that actually it was the unhygienic conditions, and it was the rats carrying the lice, then I think people changed the whole attitude towards cats. Here's the horrible plague itself. This is what one of those parasites would have looked like. And the Black Death, or the Black Plague, was absolutely devastating. It was worse than what AIDS is today, although who knows where AIDS is going. But when one third of the people died, you can imagine a lot of people thought about eternity. And people like Professor John Wycliffe said they came to Christ because of the plague. That's what drove them to the scriptures. 1377, another interesting date in history, the Great Papal Schism began. This means, first there were two popes, one in France, one in Italy. And then there were three popes, and they excommunicate one another, and they waged war against one another, and they declared one another anathema. And this is very good timing, because at this very moment, the reformers were getting started, the pre-reformers, that is, especially Professor Wycliffe, and they were saying that the Pope cannot be infallible, the Pope cannot be the head of the Church, and there the popes go and prove his point in the most wonderful way, and there's nothing better than having your enemies divided and fighting one another. As we know in our own country, in politics, when your enemies fight for one another, you can get on with the work of the kingdom so much more effectively. So, 1380, Wycliffe begins to translate the Latin Bible into English, and this was a monumentally important foundation for freedom, and these were the field workers of the Reformation. Wycliffe was excommunicated several times over. He was attacked. They wanted to kill him, but by God's grace, John of Gaunt, who was the son of one king and the father of the next king, he was a major player politically in England, and because he defended Wycliffe, Wycliffe was therefore protected from being burned at the stake. And there were many a time that the Church authorities, the Catholic authorities, would have cheerfully killed him, but it was his political connections with John of Gaunt that protected him. And the reason was because Wycliffe had defended the rights of England under King Richard III not to pay taxes to the emperor, to the Pope. And it's only one step from questioning his this, the political power of the Pope to questioning the spiritual power as well. So it was a very good move. And one of the most important foundations laid, as far as England goes, for the Reformation was when Wycliffe started to send out his Lollards. These were the field workers of the Reformation that, taking his hand-copied Bibles, went in the marketplace to sing the scriptures, to preach the scriptures, and to hand out little leaflets, which of course couldn't be printed. They were handwritten scriptures on paper. And in this way, they started the ball rolling for the Reformation to get started. They sowed the seed. And one of the people who got some of the writings of John Wycliffe was John Huss. And this was through Anne, Prince Anne, who later became Queen Anne. She came from Bohemia. She married King Richard III. And she sent back to her homeland of Bohemia a whole lot of the writings of Wycliffe. And this inspired a tremendous revival in the university in Prague. And so John Huss, who is the incendiary preacher of Prague, Jan Hus, made tremendous stand. He was excommunicated 4 times. They really wanted to make sure of this. And he was treacherously betrayed, and after being given safe conduct to the Council of Constance, they burned him at the stake while under safe conduct. Extremely brave man, very bold, and if you think of his prophecy, he said, "My goose is cooked." It's a play on words, because his name is Goose. Huss is the Bohemian word for goose. So, "My goose is cooked, but 100 years from now, a swan will arise whose voice you will not be able to silence." And that swan has been identified with Martin Luther, because 100 years later, Luther came and he made his stand. And it's true. Huss didn't have a printing press. Luther did. So what Wycliffe and Huss started, they couldn't carry further, but God was preparing Martin Luther to take the Reformation throughout the whole of Europe. And you'll notice the rebellion raised under Huss. They used the chalice. In fact, I just got one of these badges sent to me from the Hussites of Czechoslovakia, which has got the chalice superimposed over a Czech flag. So there's apparently still Hussites there making a strong stand to this day. And we know the Hussites because they surfaced in South Africa in the name of the Moravians. The Moravians are a continuation of the Hussites of Bohemia. But notice they were serving both the chalice and the bread. The Roman Catholics up to that point only allowed the laity to get the bread, not the wafer, not to get the blood of Christ in the chalice, because what if they spilled a drop of the blood of Christ? So they couldn't allow the peasants, the non-clergy, to touch the chalice. And so this was one of the rallying cries of the Reformation, is both the chalice and the bread is to be offered to the laity. And his slogan was Veritas Venit, truth conquers. And that's Huss's battle cry. And his soldiers, his followers, defeated the armies of the Holy Roman Empire and the Pope 6 times. There were 6 crusades launched against them, they won each one. Very innovative soldiers. They proved you could take on the Holy Roman Empire and win. One of the most tragic dates of destiny is AD 1453. Constantinople, the greatest city in the world at that time, fell to the Muslim Turks. The Turks destroyed this magnificent city, put everyone to the sword, men, women, and children. It was a mighty fortress. Constantinople dwarfed Rome, Paris, London, any of the cities of Europe at that time. It was the greatest city in Europe. But because they were Orthodox Christians, Greek Orthodox, the Latin Roman Catholics were not interested in coming to their support, and they pleaded for help. And the last of the Constantines, the Emperor Constantine, went charging out into the Janissaries on his horse and was never seen again. I mean, they literally just had to charge against insurmountable odds. And they had something ridiculous like 6,000 men to defend this huge city, and the Muslims came in waves of hundreds of thousands, and there was nothing that could be done except put up a brave fight. And these few soldiers overwhelmed. And a disgrace that at this critical time, Western Europe didn't come to the aid of the Eastern Christians, even though it was to our own interest in the West to have kept the Muslims on the other side of the Bosphorus, on the other side of the Hellespont in Asia. But from this point, you can see the Ottomans had already encircled over. Now that they took Constantinople, they could become a threat to Hungary, Austria, and they did. the Muslims soon after that sacked Budapest and they threatened Vienna, and Europe was never the same again. Here you can see the lines of protection and how the Muslims battered their way through each one, including by treachery. But a very good date of destiny was AD 1456, when Johannes Gutenberg produced the first printed book in the world, and it was the Bible. The Bible is the most valuable book in the world. In fact, just a while ago, one copy of the Gutenberg Bible sold for $4.5 million. US dollars, not Zimbabwe dollars. $4.5 million for one copy. And I'm told that one New Testament of William Tyndale sold recently for $2 million. Now, there's no other book in the world that can compare. If you want to say what's the most valuable book in the world, well, we know the Bible's the most valuable book. But it's, even if you only want to measure it by money, there's no other book in the world that could get that kind of price. And what other book could compare with Gutenberg's Bible? Most beautifully illustrated, magnificently on every page. Johannes Gutenberg was voted Man of the Millennium by Time Magazine, Newsweek, and a whole lot of other secular publications, because they recognized that his invention of the printing press was foundational for the information age, the scientific age, the industrial revolution, and everything else that's followed from it. And so Johannes Gutenberg was voted Man of the Millennium, which by implication means the Bible is the book of the millennium too. One of the things that Gutenberg said is, among the number of blessings which we ought to praise God is this invention, which enables the poorest to procure libraries at a low price. Is it not a great glory that volumes that used to cost 100 pieces of gold are now bought for 4, even less, and that the fruits of genius multiply over all the earth? So Gutenberg's invention enabled multiplied millions to discover for themselves great literature, and most importantly, the Word of God. One of the great dates with destiny is 1492. The liberation of Spain from Islamic occupation was completed. This is when Queen Isabella liberated Granada, the last stronghold of the Muslims in Spain. This is part of the reconquest of Spain, which for 800 years had suffered under Islamic tyranny. Now the Moors were pushed out. The Saracens were defeated. Here's the Saracen leader coming to surrender before Queen Isabella. And this is January 1492. Now what did this make possible? This opened the way. Opened the way for Columbus to explore America, because now Queen Isabella felt free to sponsor Christopher Columbus to go and discover the New World, America. And these three ships went out, very small ships actually, to cross the Atlantic. And in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. That's the poem children learn to remember the dates, 1492. And Columbus discovered the New World. He didn't expect to discover a New World. He thought he was finding a shorter way to get to Asia. I don't think he realized he discovered a new continent. He thought he was just finding a shorter way to Asia, and he wanted to use this trade route to finance a new crusade to liberate the Holy Land from the Muslims. That was his goal. That's right. Basically, when Christopher Columbus arrived, he found people there called Muhammad and Al-Hamid and Rashid and all of this. I mean, very imaginative, but not quite justified by history. You've heard some people saying that Columbus went to America for God and gold. Well, that's true, but you've got to understand he didn't want the gold for himself. He wanted the gold to finance a crusade to liberate the Holy Land from the Muslims. That was his stated goal. So they try to make it that he's some kind of Rockefeller capitalist out for personal enrichment. And so it's nice to catchy alliteration, God and gold. But you've got to understand, it's like people talking about David Livingstone came to Africa to discover the source of the Nile. David Livingstone was not an explorer first and foremost. He was a missionary, and he wanted to discover the source of the Nile because he was trying to discover God's highway to bring missionaries and relief and commerce into Africa. So he tried the Zambezi. He really hoped the Zambezi would be a highway, but of course Kapora Bassa Rapids put paid to that. The Zambezi is no good as a highway. So then he was trying the Nile. He knew that the obstacles to get into Africa were so difficult that he was hoping it'd be something like the Danube or the Rhine, that you could have trade and commerce through there. And so some will completely ignore the spiritual motivation of Livingstone and just focus on the source of Nile, not understand what the purpose is. Same thing with Columbus. Columbus was after gold, but not for personal enrichment. He really was a crusader. In fact, there's one book written by Dr. George Grant speaking about Columbus as the last crusader. That's the title of the book. And in some ways he was. Christopher Columbus, back about 20, 30 years ago, would have been voted one of the greatest men in history in America, and now they're calling him a war criminal because he came to America and brought the gospel or something terrible like that. So it just shows how America has moved from a situation where they highly respected this man, who did a great thing. He opened up America for the gospel, but now they want to trash him in the purpose of revisionist history. Still, this was a major turning point because God was preparing a whole new world for evangelism, for discipleship, and to be able to send out missionaries throughout the rest of the world. So, where's the world in 1400? Let's get an overall picture. You can see we've got, Africa's got about 31 million people, 10% of the world's population. Europe's got 44 million people, that's about 14% of the world's population. Asia, you've got about 24% of the world's population, 75 million people in East Asia. South Asia, about 75 million people, 25%. South America, you've got about 90 million people, about 6%. North America, there are only about 6 million people. 2% of the world's population lived in North America at that time. So you can see in Australasia, there are about 31,000 people estimated in the whole of Australasia, mainly because they were eating one another, so population didn't exactly increase very much at that rate. Now, in 1500, this is where the great explorers are going. And notice all these explorers come from the Christian world. And this is something that is launching out because of the Renaissance, because of the Reformation. There is this vigor now in Europe that hasn't been there in ages, and the gospel is inspiring much of this. You can see how Columbus finds the way through to Hispaniola, what today would be Haiti, Puerto Rico area. He didn't actually get on mainland America, he got to the islands, central Caribbean America. But then you've got others like Cabot and da Gama. Vasco da Gama is the one who named Natal, because he got off the coast of Natal in Zealand on Christmas Day, so Natal is the nativity named after the birth of Christ. So considering the Zulu, the name Zulu means heaven, so you've got heaven and you've got KwaZulu-Natal. You've got the place of the people of heaven and the birth of Christ brought together in one provincial name, which is interesting. And it was, of course, Vasco da Gama who would have rounded the Cape and made to Calcutta first. Also Magellan, who circumnavigated the globe, going through what is still called Magellan Straits, just south of South America. The great people of this first era of history. Yes. Yes. It's still mostly Central Asia. Yeah. That's right. Total population of more than 1,400, estimated 312 million. Do you realize that there are as many people, there are more people alive right now than have died since the time of Christ? In 20 centuries, less people have died than are alive now. The idea of this exponential growth of population, it's an extraordinary thought. And that's part of the whole evangelism explosion vision of how our evangelism has to grow with the population explosion. We can't add to the church, we've got to multiply. Addition won't win. Evangelistic crusades can add to the church, but every member evangelism, personal one-on-one evangelism, that can multiply.
What's even more extraordinary is that very less numbers of people only were great explorers and
Just extraordinary also that many people were saying how America, North America was a wilderness. And of course when they first got there, there was malaria, They were, well, John Calvin suffered from malaria in Geneva. So yet all these diseases were still there because the blessings of the gospel hadn't made full impact yet. All the diseases we have in Africa, I'm sure Ebola and everything was all over the world before the gospel blessings advanced it. So we can expect where the gospel advances, none of these diseases will affect you. And as the gospel retreats, you can expect those diseases to make comeback, which is exactly what's happening. But also, North America at that time was considered wilderness, and there wasn't enough land to sustain the 6 million odd people they think were in the whole of North America. There wasn't enough land. But now they can provide food for just about the whole world, which just goes to show all the difference is made by the gospel. The great people of this section of history, Boniface, the apostle to the Germans, the great Saxon missionary who evangelized central Germany, the Venerable Bede, who determined our dating system, which is BC and AD, the great historian of the Saxon people, King Alfred the Great, the only king of England ever called the Great, who laid the foundations for the common law, Charlemagne, Charles the Great, who was the grandson of Charles Martel the Hammer, who stopped the Muslims at the Battle of Tours, Peter Waldo, the man who founded the Waldensian movement, the evangelists and pre-reformers who did such a fine job selling the pearl of great price, Bernard of Clairvaux, one of the great monastery figures, Francis of Assisi, the friend of the animals, the courageous man who was a knight, came to the Lord in prison, as a prisoner of war in Spain, and then gave everything away and took a vow of poverty, and he even went and preached the gospel to the Sultan of Egypt during the Second Crusade. John Wycliffe, the greatest professor of the greatest university at that time, the morning star of the Reformation. And Jan Hus, a martyr for Christ, whose slogan was Truth Conquers. This brings us to the greatest century of Reformation, which we spent a lot of time in the last 3 years looking at. So we don't have to spend too much time except to look at some of the high points. The five great battle cries in Latin, Sola Scriptura, Sola Gratia, Sola Fide, Solus Christus, Soli Deo Gloria. Scripture alone is our authority. Salvation is by the grace of God alone, received by faith alone. Christ alone is the head of the church, and everything is to be done for the glory of God alone. The Reformation rediscovered the Bible and the biblical doctrines of justification by faith alone, the priesthood of all believers, grace above sacrament, scripture before tradition, faith above works. The birth dates of the Reformation, 1517, 31st of October, Martin Luther nails his 95 theses against the papal indulgences. And as a separate parallel railway track going in the same direction, Ulrich Zwingli, completely independent of Martin Luther, is launching a separate Reformation in Zurich. And he launches it on the 1st of January, 1519, by starting in Matthew 1, verse 1, and beginning expository preaching. This is the first example of expository preaching, preaching line by line, verse by verse, from the first verse of the New Testament all the way through. And this kick-started the Reformation in Zurich. And very soon they were taking all the papal idols and crucifixes and other things out of the building. And Zwingli is depicted with a big sword and a big Bible for very good reason. He used a sword, he was no pacifist. 1521, Martin Luther stands firm before the Emperor Charles V, 18th of April, great day in a church when one of the most courageous actions in church history takes place. Martin Luther stands before the assembled political religious might and he makes his bold stand. My conscience is captive to the word of God. Here I stand. I can do no other. So help me God. To go against conscience is neither holy, neither safe, nor right. Unless you can convince me by scripture or by clear reasoning, I cannot recant. And so this is where he stood. He stood firm. And as that biographer of Luther said, Archimedes, the great Greek engineer, said, if I had a place to stand, I could move the world, referring to the fulcrum. That the principle of the lever and the fulcrum is if you had a strong enough fulcrum and a bar to rest it on, if you had a place to stand, you could even move something as big as the world. Well, Martin Luther had a place to stand, it was the Bible. He had a bar, which was the law. And he had a fulcrum, which was the gospel. And with that fulcrum of the gospel, resting on the law of God, standing on the word of God, he moved the world. And the world was never the same after his message. Well, here you can see, interesting how the map of the Holy Roman Empire was in the year 1500, just before Luther. Notice how many of the dark places are church lands owned by the Roman Catholic Church, where the bishop or cardinal was effectively the prince as well. So there was a patchwork of countries and counties, some of which were Protestant, some of which were not, and this made up Central Europe at that time that the Reformation began in Saxony. 1526. A Lutheran student in Cambridge University, William Tyndale, gets fired up, converted, radical in preaching the gospel, but he has to flee Britain and go to Germany in order to translate the Bible into English. And then smuggle into England the first printed copies of the New Testament, because the Bible in English was illegal in England. And he ended up in prison, and he ended up burnt at the stake for the crime of translating the Bible into English. Something that we've had to remind a few people in our mission, because over the years we've been criticized in Frontline Fellowship for smuggling Bibles into communist and Muslim countries. And I had one man say to me, a person who lives in England now, and he said, "You're not really reformed because you are going against the laws of God. God says you've got to obey the governments, and if he has put into power a communist government in Angola that forbids Bibles to go into Angola, then obviously God doesn't want Bibles to go into Angola." Now, to say to him, "Do you know how the English Bible got into England? Do you have any idea how the first missionary to India got into India? And it was even against the laws of England. Do you understand that there never was religious freedom before the gospel went there? All missions are illegal initially because religious freedom is a fruit of the gospel. And until the gospel's gone there, it wouldn't be legal because freedom came from Christianity. So missions initially always are illegal." And most Englishmen can't believe that there was a time that the Bible in English was illegal in England, but they might be getting back to that if they carry on in their present direction. Here's a statue of William Tyndale with his printing press, very small portable printing press, and the Bible promptly displayed. 1530, Philip Melanchthon presents the Augsburg Confession, and this is really the beginning of the concept of Protestants. Of course, the word Protestant was first used at the Diet of Speyer the year before, but at the Augsburg Confession, the princes, the six princes of Germany, stood firm against the emperor and said, "We protest." That's where the whole term Protestant comes from. "You cannot command our conscience." And so, while the emperor wanted to command their allegiance to fight the Muslims, he said, "We'll fight the Muslims, but you can't command our conscience to worship in the Roman way. We will worship in the biblical way." And so, it's a pity that in the new Luther film, which is fine in many ways, but they depict at the end a very pacifist twist where the princes bow down and kneel before the emperor and said, "You can cut off my head, but we will not worship in the Roman way." In fact, they didn't bow down. They didn't offer their heads because I think Charles V would have taken them up on it. They had armies behind them and they were the electors and they said, "We will not bow." So I don't know why they depicted them bowing in a pacifist way, sort of Mahatma Gandhi type of pacifism, because they weren't pacifists. None of them were. The Lutherans fought. And they battered, finally, Charles V to the point that in 1555 he had to sign over and admit that Protestant princes could choose Protestant religion in their areas. But that's another story. 1534, King Henry VIII's Act of Supremacy and the Church of England breaks with the Church of Rome. Up till this point, it's the Church in England, the Roman Church in England. From 1534, they start to speak of the Church of England. Very different, very important difference from that one word. And it's the Chancellor, Thomas Cromwell, who is the engineer of a lot of this, from the Tower of London, which Henry VIII operated from, and his Archbishop, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Cranmer, who engineered a lot of the actual Reformation. You can see him here with his prayer book, because he's the one who authored the Book of Common Prayer. We didn't exactly author it. As he said, he compiled it from the traditions and heritage of church, going all the way back to St. Mark and many of the prayers that were taught in the church in Alexandria and further on. 1536, a very young, 26-year-old John Calvin published the Institutes of the Christian Religion. He followed in the train of the great evangelist William Farrell, who had won not only Neuchâtel and Bern to Christ, but he had even won Geneva to Christ by public debate. And on the 31st of May, it convinced all the people of Geneva to vote themselves to be a Protestant city. And it is William Farrell who put the fear of God in this 26-year-old professional student, John Calvin, that God would curse his studies if he didn't come to the aid of his church, because Calvin would have been very happy to have spent his entire life studying. But it was Farrell who conscripted him and dragged him, kicking almost, into the pastorate. And you'll notice just behind the chair of Farrell is Pierre Verret, one of the most famous French evangelists, who won many people to Christ, tens of thousands to Christ in his evangelism. And Pierre Verret was a disciple of Farrell. Well, John Calvin, there's a lot more you can say about him than most people understand. And this being the 500th anniversary of the birth of John Calvin this year, we'll be having the big celebrations later on this year in Geneva and all over, wherever we can promote this. I'm just convincing Joy Magazine to have a special edition on him as well in our July edition, and that's been accepted. John Calvin and William Farrell were actually expelled from Geneva after just 2 years there, because they wouldn't serve communion to people who were libertines, people who had low morals. And for this, they were expelled from the city, but 2 years later, they were pleaded to come back. And many of the exiles all around Europe were fleeing persecution, especially fleeing the persecution of Bloody Mary, for example, in England, came to Geneva. And Geneva was the number one place of refuge for Protestants suffering persecution, and this is what strengthened the English church and the Puritans later, because they came from Switzerland, from Geneva, and also from Zurich under Bullinger's influence. But it was John Knox who said, "Geneva is the most perfect school of Christ since the time of the apostles." It's quite an endorsement. And so you get the four main reformers in the French-speaking world depicted on the Reformation Wall: William Farrell, John Calvin, and Theodore Beza, and then John Knox on the far right. Actually, there's three French speakers, one English speaker of those four. Of course, John Knox being the English speaker. From left to right, William Farrell, John Calvin, Theodore Beza, who was the principal of the academy, and then John Knox, who is the reformer of Scotland. But while the Protestants are having their Reformation, you're going to have a counter-Reformation, because there's thesis, antithesis. Well, this is the way it goes. So 1545, the Catholics open the Council of Trent and launch the counter-Reformation. And they do many things to clean up the overt scandals of the Catholic Church, but they strengthen a lot of the heresies and doctrines as well. And so the Reformation provoked them to do some very good things in Counter-Reformation, but also provoked a lot of very evil things, such as the launching of the Counter-Reformation Inquisitions and the Jesuits, who really were secret agents, many times going into assassinations, character assassinations, literal assassinations, tortures. The Jesuits did revolutions, they did many things. And a lot of Eastern Europe, which had been going Protestant, like even Poland was heading Protestant, Hungary was going very Protestant. And because of the treachery of the Jesuits and the intrigues and the Counter-Reformation, many of these countries were lost to the Reformation later. 1549, the Archbishop Thomas Cranmer's Book of Common Prayers authorized by Parliament, making it the only liturgy that I know of and prayer book which is part of a nation's laws. It is still part of England's laws. Well, I'm sure that could be a surprise to most Englishmen and most members of Parliament there, but they still have this as the national law and liturgy and faith. A good one if they would just turn back to it. 1549, while the Protestants are sweeping up Western and Northern Europe, the Catholics start to launch out across the seas to make up for their losses in Europe by new mission fields. And Xavier goes to Japan, and he has tremendous success. And in fact, there are soon hundreds of thousands of Catholics in Japan. Although I might add, it didn't take a century when the Japanese had them all crucified and burned at the stake. I mean, it was a terrible backlash. So there was initial success of the Catholics in Japan, but then the Japanese wiped them out shortly after it. England, after an almost reformation under Henry VIII and then a real spurt of reformation under Edward VI, has a terrible reverse as 1553 Bloody Mary, Mary I, the oldest child of Henry VIII, becomes Queen of England. She is a vicious Catholic and she burns hundreds of prominent Protestants at the stake, including the finest theologian in England, the finest preacher in England at that time. You will remember their phrase, "Let us light a candle, this day in England, as shall never be put out by God's grace." And Ridley and Latimer were burned at the stake. Even her own cousin, Lady Jane, who was Queen of England for a whole 9 days, 15 years old when she was crowned, 16 years old when her head was chopped off by her beloved cousin, Bloody Mary. This is the Martyrs' Memorial in Oxford, which I've been to, and this is in memory of the four bishops, including the Archbishop of Canterbury, who was burned at the stake in Oxford. 1555, the Peace of Augsburg forces Emperor Charles V, this is the same emperor that Luther defied, to tolerate freedom of religion for Lutherans in Germany. 1558-59 was a great turning point. Bloody Mary dies. Mary, Queen of Scots, is chased out. John Knox returns to Scotland to lead the Reformation. Holland falls to the Protestants. England goes back to the Protestants. Scotland goes to the Protestants. Tremendous reversal of fortunes. 1559 is a key year. John Knox returns to Scotland and he must have preached one dynamic message. Here you can see the people in church with their armour and their pikes and their swords all present, and the military banners in the church. And as John Knox gave the amen, the people went out and they did battle. Whatever he preached galvanised them to action. And Scotland turned from being a country of 4% church attendance to a country of something in the reach of 98% church attendance in the lifetime of John Knox. One of the most dramatic victories of a nation ever. And it's a tragedy that the people of Scotland don't seem to respect John Knox anymore. In fact, his grave has been totally disappeared under a parking lot. They've put a parking lot over what was his grave. And there's still statues of John Knox in the country, but it seems the people of Scotland have forgotten what a great debt they owe to the reformers and how much was won. So, whereas you will have great honour given in Germany to the grave of Martin Luther, in Scotland they can't even tell you where it is. It's somewhere under this parking lot. You know, it's just horrific to think that the Scottish could have gone to that level.
But then the Calvinists didn't set its downs with them. That's why John Calvin's grave is sort of unmarked.
You don't even know where it is? Yes. That's also true. They didn't set the same store by it as the Lutherans would have. It's true. 1563, one of the most important books in the history of the Reformation, Fox's Book of Martyrs, was published. This book started with the persecution of the Christians under the Romans and how the 12 apostles died, and goes through showing how it's always been a Christian heritage of many brave people giving their lives for the faith. But it gives most of its attention to the persecutions of Bloody Mary and the Catholics against the Christians. And particularly it's got many pages there on the courage of of Lady Jane, for example, and the daughter of the Reformation that we've looked at here. Many of these different testimonies are in the book, Fox Book Martyrs. It used to be compulsory reading in Sunday schools. It's one of the world's bestsellers. It comes just below Pilgrim's Progress as one of the greatest bestsellers of all time. Unfortunate that many people don't have it. I insisted that we always keep it in stock in Christian Liberty Books. One of the greatest battles in history, 1571, the Battle of Lepanto destroyed the Turkish fleet. It was just not far off the coast of Greece near Corinth, and the Turkish fleet, absolutely colossal and massive, something like 231 ships, they lost all but 13. 200 and something ships of theirs destroyed by the Christians. The Austrian, German, Spanish combined military and navy, the European Christian fleet under Don John, who was a half-brother of Charles V, but he did something good here, absolutely annihilated the Turkish fleet, and this was such a victory. This was followed up by the incredible courage of the Knights of Malta. You might have heard of St. Elmo's Fire. Well, St. Elmo was one of the courageous little outposts on the island of Malta, opposite the bay, and it wasn't the biggest fort, but it was an important one. And these small band of knights, there's only about 1,400 knights, and they held fast, and every night there'd be more rowing across the harbour to St. Elmo's to fight further, killing the Turks in great numbers. And they won. Everyone in St. Elmo's lost their lives, but they so bloodied the Turks that by the time they'd finished, by the time they got to St. Elmo's, they gave up. They knew they'd never get the main castle in Malta, and so the Knights of Malta held Malta, which was an important Christian outpost for many, many, many centuries. And if they'd won at Lepanto, if they'd won at Malta, the history of the Mediterranean world would be very different. But after the tremendous victory, there was a horrible, treacherous backstabbing, 1572 St. Bartholomew Day Massacre in France, and this spread all over, not just Paris, but all over France, something in the region of 30,000 Protestants butchered in one day. And the Pope was so excited about this that he actually ordered special gold coins minted showing Christians being killed and Catholic priests holding their crucifixes over them, and had special celebrations and masses set in thanksgiving for all the Protestants killed in France, which was a tremendous tragedy because France was so close to becoming Protestant. Only 20% of France were Protestant at that stage, but 80% of the nobles were Protestant. And so France was so close to a tipping point where it could have gone Protestant. In fact, the very next king of France could have been Protestant. And it was this treachery that set the cause of the Reformation back very far. 1582, Rishi, another Catholic missionary, went to China and won many, many Chinese to the Catholic faith. So again, the Catholics, while they were losing in Europe, they were gaining overseas. But 1588, the Spanish Armada defeated by the English Navy. Now, look at the timing. In 1571, the Spanish Navy was part of the coalition that defeated the Turks at Lepanto. Unbeatable, the greatest superpower in the world. Spain was unbeatable. But now that minuscule little English Navy. At this stage, Spain was something in the region of an 18 million population. England was a population of about 3 million. England was a backwater, small little provincial power, and the Navy was really pathetic. It was totally inadequate. There's no way that you could expect the superpower that even beaten the Turks to have been beaten by the little English Navy. And the English Navy couldn't have beaten them. But God intervened in the most amazing ways, and through storms and through some of the harassment done by courageous people, Sir Francis Drake and others, and then the Dutch had their part also in delaying the launch of the Duke of Parma's barges from Holland, which were the invasion barges. Many things worked so well in order to defeat the Spanish Armada, but it was summed up the best by a coin that was minted by Queen Elizabeth: God blew, and they were scattered. And that is one. And on the other side of the coin says, man proposes, God disposes. The greatest empire that time proposed a plan, but God disposed of them. And the Armada was crushed. In fact, they went out to attack England. They got harassed. There were all sorts of raids where Sir Francis Drake and others raided them and burned many of the ships in the harbours and slowed them down by months and a year. And this was a long time coming. And by the time they came, they were so beaten up in the straits that they tried to escape. They knew they couldn't get below, so they tried to go over the top of Scotland. They were hit by the worst storms. They lost just about everything. It was such a defeat, very little limped back into their harbours in Spain. And that was the end of Spain as a superpower, naval power. And as a result of this, Holland and England grow to be a great, two great naval powers. And as a result, Cape Town's founded, South Africa's established as a Protestant country. Many things happen as a result. North America becomes Protestant, which wouldn't have been possible if Spain had been a superpower. Major turning point in history. Spanish Armada defeated by the English Navy. So, this is one of the watersheds, certainly in terms of naval power. Interesting that two of the greatest naval engagements happened within two decades. 1571 Lepanto and 1588 Spanish Armada. At one point the Spaniards are on the right side and the other side, they're on the wrong side. 1598, the greatest century Reformation ends with the Edict of Nantes, granting French Protestant religious liberty. And King Henry, who was a Protestant in his upbringing, who said Paris is worth a mess, converts to Catholicism, gets the country, and then he immediately gives religious freedom to the Protestants. So how true his conversion was to Catholicism can be debated, but it gave almost a century of peace and freedom for the Protestants. Many good things happened out of that. So, are the greatest century of Reformation? The greatest figures are without a doubt Martin Luther, Ulrich Zwingli, William Tyndale, William Farrell, John Calvin, John Knox, Thomas Cranmer, and Heinrich Bullinger, the consolidator of the Reformation. And William of Orange, who's a political figure who fought for the independence of Holland very courageously, very effectively, using his own money to finance the beginnings of the Dutch Navy, which really crushed the Spaniards and gave them some of the worst defeats they've ever had. Yes. That's right. And that's why the South African flag is not the red, white and blue of Holland, but the orange, white and blue honouring William of Orange. And that's why, yes, all the five bastions of the castle are all named after titles and provinces of Orange under the titles of William of Orange. Very great man, also known as William the Sound, murdered by a Jesuit assassin. This brings us to the 1600s, the 17th century, the age of the Puritans. I call the 17th century the greatest century of the Puritans. And this starts with 1611, a publication of the King James Version of the Bible, definitely one of the greatest Bibles of all time. Although, let it be said, it had nothing to do with King James. He didn't translate a word. It's how some reprobate, unsaved monarch got the name of this Bible beats me, because it's a good translation of the Bible, but it was the Puritans that did it. And King James never even authorized it. It's not really the authorized Bible, because he didn't even authorize it. The only truly authorized Bible in the history of England is the Coverdale Bible, which Henry VIII authorized. That's a genuine authorized Bible. That's on the cover of our Greatest Century of Reformation book. That's the book that had a royal stamp of approval, but this one, King James, was more than lukewarm about it. But that doesn't matter. It's a great Bible, and wonderfully used of God. And 90% of its New Testament translation is the work of William Tyndale. So if they're going to name it after someone, I would have called it the William Tyndale Bible. But 1618, one of the worst wars ever to hit Europe, occurred, possibly worse even than the effects of the First World War in terms of just death toll was horrific. 1618, 30 years war between the Catholics and Protestants begins. You can see some of the movements between them. It was a seesaw war. Protestants won some, Catholics won others. Tremendous changes. All of this basically started because the Catholics are about to take Holland. And then the Dutch financed an uprising in Hungary, hoping that this would pull them away. And the Bohemia gets involved in it, so throwing the emperor's officials out the window. And before you know it, the Bohemians are winning. Catholics organize the most horrific counterattack. And a lot of this, the Dutch actually financed in order to draw the war away from Holland. Everything got out of control. Germany became a wasteland of pillaging armies. The Austrians came through doing the most horrific atrocities throughout Germany. Pillaging, burning. But during the same time, the Pilgrims signed the Mayflower Compact and sailed for America. Now, the fact that Europe was going through the 30 Years' War at this stage, not that they knew that yet, it was only 2 years into it, gives you an explanation why the Protestants who were in Holland wanted to move away from Europe. They didn't want to get caught up in another war. Many Americans say that the Pilgrims sailed for America for religious freedom. Not true. They had religious freedom in Holland. They sailed away so they could bring up their children in the English language in religious freedom in America. Because they could bring up their children in Holland. It's just as they would be more influenced by the Dutch way, and so they might have lost their language and their culture. But they had full religious freedom as Protestants in Holland. They didn't go to America for religious freedom. They went there to preserve their culture and their heritage and their religious freedom, both together. And these are the Pilgrims walking to church carrying their rifles. a famous picture that I've used a few times. Once in a Presbyterian church where some pastor got awfully irate because I'd shown pictures of Sudanese pastors carrying rifles. He was aghast. How can Christians in Sudan carry rifles? And I said, well, in your foyer of your church, you've got a picture of pilgrims walking to church carrying rifles, and didn't your churches fine men who came to church without a rifle in the 17th century because they were being irresponsible, not protecting their family? He had to walk out to the foyer to have a look. And, oh, yeah, he'd never noticed that before. Amazing how people... And then I said, could I ask you, what do you actually celebrate on the 4th of July in America? What do you mean? Well, wasn't that a bunch of homeschooling fathers with guns that rebelled against Great Britain and brought about religious freedom in America? And they'd obviously forgotten what they're celebrating on the 4th of July as well. Pocahontas is famous because she's the first Indian to be baptized into the Christian faith. And this is part of a massive wall oil painting in the rotunda of the American House of Congress. It's a pity that Hollywood has now made Pocahontas synonymous with a pagan, I talk to the trees, New Ager, whereas she is actually a Bible-believing Christian. And just to compound it, they brought out another hideous film called The New World, which is with Colin Farrell in it, as the most confused 21st century character suddenly shoved back into the 16th century. John Smith was one of the most dynamic evangelical Christians and powerful, courageous soldiers, and it turned him into a wimp, a weed, who's endlessly just feeling sorry for himself and looks like he's about to burst into tears all the time. This courageous man who took on the Turks and fought the Muslims all throughout the Middle East and had been one of the pioneers of evangelism in America, and then it turned him into this absolute pitiful teenage wimp. What on earth is going on when Hollywood can make films like that? It's absolutely outrageous. But Pocahontas, let's remember, is a sister in Christ. She is someone who really knew the Lord, although I'm afraid there's hundreds of millions of people today who would never have guessed that from the Hollywood films. 1628, Comenius is driven from his homeland. He's a Bohemian involved in pioneer Christian education. 1631, King Gustavus Adolphus of Sweden saves German Protestants from annihilation. And he intervenes, very courageous, very dedicated. We've had a whole session here on King Gustavus Adolphus, who turned Sweden, our little country of 1 million people, into a superpower of his time, a major player, and swept in, and his Protestant faith, he knew he would probably never come back to Sweden alive, and he didn't. He gave his life and died in Germany, fighting to save the heartland of the Reformation from the Austrians. And before his last battle, King Gustavus Adolphus giving the battle over into the hands of the Lord. And then the English Civil War. At about the same time, in a sense, you could consider the English Civil War part of the 30 Years' War in Europe. Oliver Cromwell's the key figure here, the ultimate Puritan general, the ultimate Puritan statesman. And the English Civil War, like the 30 Years' War across the border, really did cross the channel. This modernized the army, and in many ways the English soldiers involved in the English Civil War under Cromwell, the Ironsides, the New Model Army, and King Gustavus Adolphus' Protestant Swedish army are the forerunners of a truly professional army. Very courageous. Cromwell, like Gustavus Adolphus, led from the front, frequently wounded in action, and was ultimately very successful. He won all his battles, and he beat the Scots, he beat the Irish, he beat the Royalists, he brought the king to trial. And Oliver Cromwell was a man who truly feared God and forced the king to trial. He also is the man who founded the first English-speaking mission society in the world, and he designed a whole plan for evangelizing the whole world. And he put something like £15,900, which in 1600s money is colossal, into evangelizing the Red Indians of North America, who at that stage were under English control, of course, remember, North America's now being an English colony. And so he had a great vision for winning the Indians to Christ. He is one of only two people who have their statues inside the grounds of the House of Commons. One is Richard the Lionheart, the other is Oliver Cromwell. And there's many a time that royalists and others have wanted to pull down Cromwell's statue, but dear friend, Dr. Ian Paisley and others, the members of Parliament, have said that they've resolutely stood firm that if there wasn't an Oliver Cromwell, there wouldn't be a Parliament of England having any of the authority it has, and therefore he stays. And so there's many a time that the battles over Cromwell's statue, but he's there to remind them. You've got to go across the road to find people like Winston Churchill in Parliament Square, but inside the grounds of Parliament, it's only Richard the Lionheart, who the Muslims hate, and they want it out there. In fact, they've now had to make the whole area where Richard the Lionheart statue is no-go area to the public, police protecting the barricades, because Muslims have threatened to blow up the statue of Richard the Lionheart many a time. Also, the Muslims in England want the English flag changed, because they say Richard the Lionheart designed the flag of St. George, which is true. The red cross on white, the flag of England, is Richard the Lionheart's crusader banner, which was adopted after the time of Richard the Lionheart as the flag of England. So it is a crusader flag. But so what? Are the Muslims going to take their swords and crescents and all that out of their flags of Saudi Arabia or anything like that? Not likely. Under the protection of Oliver Cromwell's new model army, the Westminster Assembly met and they designed the Westminster Confession of Faith and the Westminster Standards, the Westminster Catechisms, certainly the finest definition of biblical teaching ever. And the Westminster Confession of Faith stands as a tremendous magnetic north as to what's good, sound, fine Christian teaching. By 1648, the Peace of Westphalia ends the 30 Years' War, and this is how Europe basically gets settled. Interestingly enough, France came in the final years of the war on the side of the Protestants, although France was Catholic. Cardinal Richelieu understood that a strong Austria dominating the whole of Europe would not have been good, not good for France. So he ended up thinking, well, better a Protestant victory than a too strong Austria. And so in the end, the French came in on the Protestant side and gave the Austrians a serious blood nose, and that preserved Germany for the Protestant cause for many centuries thereafter. Notice how at the end of the Peace of Westphalia, Austria is quite large. Poland, Lithuania is massive. Absolutely massive. And Sweden now covers both Finland and Sweden at that stage. Notice how the Ottoman Empire was all the way up to the gates of Vienna and had taken Budapest in Hungary. Notice how the Spanish kingdoms even included southern Italy. So Europe looked quite different at that point. But the Swiss are still pretty consistent with their little Alpine independence kingdom going there, or republic, I should say. Interesting. 1666, the year after the restoration, well, actually in 1660, the restoration took place a year after Oliver Cromwell had died. Parliament, with the conniving of the Presbyterians, handed over the Republic of England, the Commonwealth of England, over to the Charles II, who was the son of Charles I, who had been beheaded for treachery. And they were very foolish. These Presbyterian members of Parliament managed to get Charles II to promise that he would make Presbyterianism the religion of England. And when he promised that, swore blind, signed the Solemn League and Covenant, they let him come in, betrayed the Commonwealth, the King took power again, and immediately ignored his Solemn League and Covenant, and he just brought Episcopalian Church of England type of belief back in, with a very Romanish tinge, and he persecuted the Puritans terribly. Thousands of Puritans, like John Bunyan, got thrown in prison. And shortly after this, the Great Fire destroyed most of London, which many saw as Antichrist 666 and God's judgment on a London that had turned away from the paradise. That's why you get John Milton, who wrote Paradise Lost and Paradise Regained, and was all over the fact that they were gaining paradise with this Puritan republic, and now they've gone back to the papacy. The year six. Oh, the people saw the symbolism 666 right there, the Great Fire of London. And this was a horrific destruction. You can see here the old St. Paul's is going up. Sir Christopher Wren built the new St. Paul's on that area. And it's called St. Paul's because they believe St. Paul preached there, by the way. There's also the Tower of London, one of the few things that stayed. Just about everything else got destroyed. Absolutely devastating fire. Yes, that's true. The plague, same, the bubonic plague had made a resurgence. in England about this time. In fact, a lot of it was, honestly, they were very unhygienic, immoral, and there's just such a lot of immorality that came in with the Restoration, the so-called Restoration that came in with Charles II. Charles II brought in such a lot of French immorality, and London really was becoming one big immoral city. So this fire purged the city in many ways, and it got rid of a lot of the disease. In Cape Town, yes, the Dutch were on the ascendancy at that stage. 1678, John Bunyan's The Pilgrim's Progress is published, written entirely in prison. This is a very courageous man. John Bunyan was a soldier in his teens in Cromwell's army. He was an Ironsides who later was a Baptist preacher and locked up for preaching the gospel without a license. Terrible thing to preach the gospel without a license. We've got quite a lot on John Bunyan, author of one of the greatest bestsellers of all time. So the great figures of this stage, Gustavus Adolphus, the King of Sweden, Oliver Cromwell, the Puritan head of state of England, John Owen, he's one of the greatest English authors of all time, and he was the secretary of, John Owen was the chaplain of Oliver Cromwell. John Bunyan, one of the greatest authors of all time. I could have also added Milton, as who is the secretary of Oliver Cromwell, should have also been there. So this is how the world looks at about this time, at the beginning of the 1700s. You can see how far the Russian Empire is, the Chinese Empire. This is the Muslim Mongol Empire. The Hindus are crushed at this stage. They're being wiped out by the Muslims at this time. You can see the different Ottoman empires around the side. The Spanish have taken the whole western shore of America, and the Portuguese have taken the eastern shore. And this ushers in the greatest century of revival. 1685, Louis XIV revokes the Edict of Nantes and exiles many thousands of French Huguenots, some of which come even to the Cape, and hence we have French Hook. But this was disastrous. Hundreds of thousands of French Protestants fled France at that time, fleeing to England, Holland, Germany, America. The film, The Patriot, on the American War of Independence, has as its key figure a man based on the Marsh Fox, who was actually a descendant of the French Huguenots, and his grandfather would have fled from the persecution of the French. And for some reason, they edited that out so that you never understood why there was such hostility between him and the French. It's because he came from French ancestry, and his Protestant ancestors have been persecuted by the French. And so I don't know why that somehow didn't make it into the final frames of the film. But Louis XIV is called the Sun King. Many people think he's a wonderful king. Hollywood's given him a lot of very positive portrayals, but he's actually one of the worst. And he persecuted the Protestants horrifically. 1685, the births of both Johann Sebastian Bach and George Frederick Handel, two of the greatest musicians of all time. 1707, a publication of Sir Isaac Watts's Hymns and Spiritual Songs, which were ushering in the greatest century of hymns. In many ways, the 1800s was the greatest century of hymns. And Sir Isaac Watts started the ball rolling in the 1700s, but by the 1800s, absolutely phenomenal hymns that grew out of the Great Awakenings. 1727, Awakening at Herrnhut launches the Moravian Brethren, who are descendants of the of the Hussites. And of course the Moravians went very far on missions, even ending up here in the Cape. First mission station in the Cape, Carnarvonville, not far from here. 1735, the Great Evangelical Awakening begins under Jonathan Edwards. 1738, John Wesley's conversion, the Holy Club, the Methodist dynamic evangelists. Between Wesley and Whitfield, they evangelized England very effectively, and if they hadn't, secular historians agree, England would have gone under a revolution much like France. But while England was having a revolution, while England was having a revival, France having a revolution, and that's what makes the difference. 1739, George Whitefield starts open-air preaching, very radical, but many people come to the Lord. Tens of thousands came to Christ in this great evangelical awakening, changing the face, spiritual face of England and North America. Very few people have recognized the close link between George Whitfield's preaching, Jonathan Edwards' work, the revival in America just before America's independence from England. Spiritually, in many ways, George Whitfield and Jonathan Edwards are the grandfathers of American independence. They're the ones who laid the foundations, which the other generation were able to benefit from. Notice all the heckling, people hitting him, firing muskets next to his ear, blowing trumpets. There's just this harassment of him because so many people hated his preaching, but it didn't stop them. 1742, one of the greatest musical accomplishments ever, Handel's Messiah, was performed. 1776, the Continental Congress adopts the Declaration of Independence for America. And notice how all of the flags here have the English and the British flags in their flags. And it needs to be remembered, although Obama would like to change it, he'd like to suggest that there are Muslims and Hindus and atheists standing around here, but they're plainly not only all English and Anglo-Saxon and Protestants overwhelmingly, but they're all God-fearing people. And they were very much taking as the foundational principle lex rex, the law is king, God's law. And so, despite terrible war and lots of bloodshed, they achieved independence and won a country that became a city on a hill, an example, and a great Protestant bastion, sending out the gospel to many countries around the world. So the American War of Independence is a very key point. As some have said, the shot that was fired on the Lexington lawn was heard around the world, and certainly the dates of liberty throughout the whole world came from there. George Washington receiving Cornwallis's surrender. 1780, foundation of Sunday schools.
Sorry, when was Sunday?
That was 1742, first time. 1742. And I've got the notes here with the main dates. It doesn't have everything said, but all the dates are on the notes in the middle of the table here. 1780, Robert Raikes begins Sunday schools. 1789, one of the worst events in history, the French Revolution. This was a humanist revolution. This is the result of evil teachings of Voltaire and Robespierre, secular humanism run rampant. It was an anti-God revolution, 30,000 heads chopped off by the guillotine, 300,000 killed, 40,000 heads chopped off by the guillotine, 300,000 killed by firing squads, millions dead through the Napoleonic Wars. This showing the church aflame, ministers being hung, people being beheaded, and church things desecrated. This actually symbolizes the French Revolution in perspective. It was an anti-Christian revolution. They literally abolished the Christian calendar. They tried to make 1792 the first year, year one. They tried to have a 10-day week to abolish the Christian 7-day week. Everything that spoke of Christianity, they wanted to get rid of. They took a prostitute and enthroned her as the goddess of reason in the Notre Dame. It was a very vile event. So 1789, here you can actually see they organized new worship of the state to worship the goddess of reason. Insane. So, religion's bad, but we're going to invent our own. A lot of bloodshed, a lot of destruction. And the interesting thing about the French Revolution is the architects ended up in the same guillotine themselves. All of them, including Robespierre himself. He ended up in the guillotine himself. It just shows communism is cannibalistic. And make no mistake, the French Revolution was communistic. And Marx and Lenin are absolutely right to say this is a prototype of the Russian Revolution. The French Revolution is evil, and I was horrified in South Africa when in 1989, South Africa was printing French Revolution 200-year anniversary stamps. We refused to stop use them for our mailings. I remember sending them all back saying we won't take it. By the way, just recently, we were given a whole lot of Mandela stamps from the post office, and I had to send them all back. I'm not putting any pagan politicians stickers on any of our mailings. Never. Tell them I want some nice animals. So took them back and we got some nice animal stamps. But I mean, outrageous. Putting some politician's picture on it. But in 1989, South Africa was publishing stamps to celebrate the French Revolution. I wrote letters to editors of all sorts of publications saying, what are we celebrating? 40,000 heads chopped off, 300,000 people killed in firing squads, millions dead, desecration of churches. What exactly was there good about the French Revolution? Name me one thing. They said democracy. You have got to be kidding. What democracy? Those massacres. the prototype dictator, Napoleon, comes to power through. Tell me what was good about the French Revolution. Everything they brought up, not true, false. But I remember at school even, in Rhodesia, having very positive chapters on the French Revolution, like what a nice thing it was. There's no comparison between the American War of Independence and the French Revolution. That's why it's wrong to speak of the American Revolution. It wasn't a revolution. It was a war of independence. They weren't a revolution going against Christian values. The French Revolution, unfortunately, some Americans misunderstood and thought, like Thomas Jefferson thought the French Revolution was like the American Revolution. But after a while, he realized it is nothing of the sort. It's anti-Christian everywhere. And so, Napoleon. In fact, I think this is why an Animal Farm, George Orwell names the Lenin characters called Napoleon in Animal Farm. And it's true, because Napoleon in some ways, although he looks good compared to Lenin, but still, he was a prototype for Lenin, very much the same kind of dictatorial idea. So, for the 18th century, the greatest figures are Isaac Watts in hymns, Jonathan Edwards in theology, one of the greatest minds America's ever produced, George Whitefield, certainly the greatest open-air evangelist of all time, John Wesley, very vigorous evangelist. Although he and Whitefield were on opposite sides theologically, though, they were friends, amazingly. And this is how the world looked like at the end of the 1700s. About the year 1800, you can see how the Qing Empire of China has gone quite far, the Russian Empire stretching further, Persia's got quite a bit of space, the Ottoman Empire's lost ground, the Portuguese and Spaniards have consolidated their control of Brazil and Spain. That's going to change in the 1900s. Africa's mostly open. Portuguese, a bit in Mozambique and Angola, but most of Africa's quite open and free of European influence, but not free from Muslim slave traders who are raiding all over Africa.